The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And now, it's time for the talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello, good morning to you. 5 minutes past nine. It's Monday, the 3rd of April, 2023. How are you keeping? I hope you had a lovely weekend as we head into a fresh new week. On a fresh day, actually. It seems quite pleasant out there. Hope it is the same wherever you are. We are open for business now. The phone line's open. You can give Caroline or Anya a call right now on 07491 25000. Is there something you want to talk about? Something you want to get off your chest? Now, this can be something that put you down over the weekend, or something that elevated you as well. We want to hear all of your stories too, by the way. We're not just here looking for negative stuff or stuff that affects you in a negative way. If you've had something good happen to you too, we want to hear it. You can WhatsApp or text us on 086 60 25000. WhatsApps and texts 086 60 25000, and emails come to us at comments@highlandradio.com. and of course, if you want to, if you haven't before, make sure if you want to watch the show, you can head on over to YouTube, Highland Radio Ireland. That's through your Fire Stick, your smart TV, tablet, laptop, wherever where you want to watch us, or across our Facebook pages. Good morning to Tracy and Michael, who are already joining us watching the programme today. Let's look at the newspapers this morning, and we'll go inside the Donegal News. Tourists turning their backs on Ireland because of accommodation shortage. And I think we're going to be hearing an awful lot more about this. This is in the context, of course, that over 50% of Donegal's hotel rooms are currently being used to deal with the refugee crisis. So half of the rooms available in this county already are occupied. Fáilte, Ireland's most senior official, has told the Oireachtas that visitors are turning to other countries because of the lack of accommodation here. Paul Kelly was among a panel of representatives to address the Tourism, Culture, Arts, Sports and Media Committee. Delegates from the Irish Hotels Federation and the Irish Tourism Industry Confederation also made submissions on the challenges facing the visitor sector in Ireland at the moment. Paul Kelly said that as things stand, 1 in 3 guest beds outside of Dublin is contracted in the state for use as international protection accommodation. And as I mentioned, in Donegal, that figure stands at around 50%. It's a little higher, I think about 52%. So what impact that will have on tourism, tourists coming here? Because if you can't get accommodation, you don't go somewhere. You don't turn up, you know, on a wing and a prayer. You book your holiday, and if you can't get accommodation, you simply just don't go there. Now, that's all right. If the hotels are full, they're making money, probably more money than they ever made, because there's guaranteed occupancy, those that are involved in that scheme. But there is your local cafes, your local restaurants and so on and so forth that won't see the footfall that they might ordinarily see. And as I said, this is something we were talking about well over a year ago. And the chickens now are coming home to roost. That's accommodation for tourists. What about accommodation for people living here? It's covered across all papers again today. It's a story that's simply not going to go away. And why should it go away? The Irish Times: the coalition is braced for further controversy over the ending of the eviction ban, with new figures set to show that thousands of notices to quit rented properties were served on tenants at the end of last year. Just days after the moratorium came to an end, the Residence Tenancies Board is due to publish data outlining how many landlords issued a notice to quit to a tenant in the final quarter of 2022. Now, we know there's already, 4,000 were issued. That was before the last quarter of last year, when they were anticipating this no-fault eviction ban ending. So it could be an avalanche. The draft version of the report has been shared with government officials, and according to a source, shows a similar number of notice of terminations being issued between October and December as in the previous 3 months. A total of 4,741 such notices were issued between last July and September. The government decided not to extend the ban on the so-called no-fault evictions beyond March 31st, which it put in place in October 30th. Last, due to a severe shortage of accommodation as winter approached. It prevented landlords from evicting people, even if they could be issued with a valid notice of termination. So, as I say, that's one that's going to rumble on and on and on. Owen O'Brien for the opposition has been a key figure, obviously, from an opposition perspective in holding the government to account. And he did so, or tried to do so, with a tweet at the weekend, which I understand the point he was trying to make. And if you take the politics aside, I mean, his party obviously very much opposed to the ending of the eviction ban, but it was an image without any explanation that didn't have Eamon Ryan in it, it didn't have Leo Varadkar in it, it didn't have Micheál Martin in it, it didn't have landlords in it, it didn't have arguably all the people that you might feel, or some might feel, might be responsible for the ending of that eviction ban. Instead, it had Gardaí, and it was Gardaí sort of superimposed, and it was Gardaí from an actual eviction, by the way. It is a work they do carry out. Gardaí superimposed on a famine eviction. It drew an awful lot of anger from government TDs. Of course, they're going to hop all over it. But also members of An Garda Síochána were upset at it because Eamon Ryan then had to explain, and when you're explaining, you know yourself, that the Gardaí weren't the target of his point. It was the government, but it was the Gardaí that were front and centre. So the Gardaí are upset at it. Did you see the image? What did you think? 086 60 25,000. I described it on social media as a PR disaster. And of course, then loads of people were sort of getting on to me about this, that and that. It's not about the politics, right? But if you want to make a point, and then you say no words needed, but then you have to explain it. And there's going to be more explanations going to happen at the start of the week. It's not good PR. It could have been done in a different way, perhaps. But he stands by it, and that's up to him. But Justice Minister Simon Harris, obviously he saw this as something that he could get involved in. He'll today strongly criticise Sinn Féin for increasing the risk of attacks on members of An Garda Síochána through what he deems are inaccurate and provocative posts on social media. Now, I'm not quite sure it'll increase risks of attack, but what it did invite is an awful lot of criticism of An Garda Síochána from all political spectrum. Those who have an issue with the guards, it was like a red light or green light, sorry, to sort of jump on it and criticise them. And I think that's what's going to bother the Gardaí more, even though they do be involved in these type of evictions, even more so than the risk of attack. But anyway, in remarks clearly referring to a weekend post by Sinn Féin housing spokesperson Eamon Ryan, which borrows heavily from artwork relating to land war evictions in Ireland of the late 19th century, Mr. Harris is expected to say that this approach to an already sensitive issue is dangerous at a time when assaults, hostility and aggression against Gardaí are on the increase. The minister's comments will come as he addresses the annual conference of the Association of Garda Sergeants and Inspectors. But I'd be very interested to hear what the AGSI believes the government is doing to offer them any further protection, because the guards are looking for measures which aren't yet forthcoming. So it'll be interesting to see what kind of reception the Justice Minister gets in that context. Staying with the Gardaí, this is in the Irish Daily Mail. Gardaí have criticised unfair comments by Commissioner Drew Harris that staff who misgender colleagues could face disciplinary action, and have called for the new transgender policy to be withdrawn. In February, the force issued a new policy document, Gender Identity in the Workplace, which stated that compliance was mandatory for all An Garda Síochána members and staff. Last week, Mr. Harris said that the misgendering of a person could lead to discipline. Those comments have sparked anger amongst Gardaí, who say they have there has been a lack of consultation and education on the subject. The topic will be discussed at the 45th Annual Association of Garda Sergeants and Inspectors Delegate Conference, which meets today in Galway. Right, on to the tabloids now. Not a great deal in them, not going to lie to you. Let's start with the Irish Daily Star. Security will be boosted at the Aintree Grand National after a plot by animal rights activists to sabotage the event was exposed. And I'm really surprised this hasn't happened on a grand scale before. I do recall a number of decades ago someone running out in front of the Grand National. But more than 100 protesters had reportedly backed Animal Rebellion's plan to make a statement in front of the iconic racing event's global audience. Undercover footage showed members talking of using ladders and bolt cutters to beat security fences at Aintree ahead of the race on April 15th before gluing themselves together as a human barrier on the course. Animal Rebellion wants all animal farming and fishing banned and an end to horse racing, which is claimed is animal abuse. But they were caught out undercover plotting that, and now security has been greatly increased. I read this because I don't believe it. Do you feel that you have to change your accent for your smart speaker? Lots of you out there now, and many of you listening on this, are listening on your Alexa, your Dot, or your Google Home. But apparently, That's a smart speaker, by the way, that's connected to the internet and you can just give it voice commands. A quarter of Irish people admit to toning down their accent because voice-activated devices like Alexa can't understand them. A study found 72% of the population use voice assistants during the course of the day, but with varying success. Some 46% of Kerry folk, 44% of West Meath locals, and 40% of those in Mayo and Sligo confessed to modifying their pronunciation to the machine so it could comprehend them. A fifth also acknowledged screaming at the application in frustration when it was unable to carry out their wishes. I've done that, I'm not going to lie to you. Residents in West Meath, 38%, Galway, 29%, and Mayo, 27%, were found to be the most likely to lash out at voice assistants after accent-related hiccups. I don't see a figure for Donegal here. I'll have another glance through. We probably got a press release into the email at some point. But do you find that you have to tone down your accent for your smart speaker to fully respond to you? Let us know. I know it's not the most important thing in the world too, but there's light and shade. 086 60 25,000. Do you have to sell your soul, really, so your smart speaker will switch your lights off or play Highland Radio? And finally in the Sun today, big nosed blokes are now check your wing mirror or check your your back mirror or turn to your right and have a look at his nose. Big-nosed blokes are more likely to cheat on their partners, a poll says. More than half, 52%, who admit doing the dirty sport above-average-sized hooters. Of those, 78% believe women are attracted by their large facial organs, but only 10% said the women they had flings with also possessed a large honker. We're joined on the programme now by Marion. Good morning, Marion.
Hi, good morning, Greg.
Good to chat to you. Now, talk to me about these flash floods. It was Friday evening, wasn't it, as we headed towards 7 o'clock. You were out and about. What did you see?
I would normally, it's up in the Drumfergus area here, up past the crossroads. I would normally travel this road on a regular basis because I go up there and I turn, you know, left up at the junction to get up to my house. But I travel often and pretty often it's flooded, and quite badly flooded, and especially the last house seems to take, as you go up the hill, seems to take the brunt of all the water. And I've noticed it over the past 6 or 7 years that I've lived up here, and you know, I've seen the council has been out a couple of years ago trying to fix the problem, because the wee man in the last house is always getting flooded. And it goes down in quite a bit of force. But Friday night was just an alleviate soul. It was that bad. I had to move the car, obviously, because it was like a river coming down the whole road. And I got my daughter to film the road because the road was actually breaking up. And there was no way you could get up the road. It's just a flow of a river coming down, and I noticed a couple of the neighbours were out at the end house, especially where this elderly man lives. The big boards, some type of boards, and I don't know if it was a manhole or whatever, it was too far up to see myself, trying to help the man to save his house. And then the other houses below his house, you know, obviously potential. I've never seen anything like it. I've seen it once in Norway, a road breaking up, you know, to some extent. But I've never seen this before, ever. You know, I'm 58, been driving for 38 years or so.
Yeah.
And as I was turning the car, you know, it was going out to the other houses as well. It's some force, and you could actually see in the video the road breaking up as Robin, my daughter, was taking the video. So I headed back down the road, went back into the crossroads at the village, and attempted to go up by Donegal Creameries, up past the Bad Bed, the locals know it, and take a left and try and reach my home from the upper way. Took a left and drove down there, and that was just, it was a force, it was frightening, and it was like a river, and it wasn't as though it was a river had burst or anything, because we're up at the top of the mountain here, we're chatting. So So I had to actually reverse the car all the way back up onto the main road, then head up the Glenelly Primary School and go round by the left. And it ended, a 2 minute journey ended up taking me half an hour. I was just so shocked. People having to put up with that. These people living, I've seen it constantly flood, well, not constantly, regularly flooded in the past 6-7 years. But and the scale, actually, whenever I was turning my car, I spoke to one of the neighbours, and I says to him, I've never seen anything like this before, you know, in Ireland. I says, and I've seen it flooded here often, but this is just, and he had said that the council had been up a couple of years ago, and even after that, he says, what it is today, he says it was like this even in the past couple of years. This is the second time for it to be in such a bad state. Apparently, it ruined his garden. His garden with the force of the water. And I know a friend of mine lives in one of the houses. I heard that even the concrete in our yard, it was tearing up, you know, their house, tearing that up. Now, I don't know how bad that is. And then so that ended up, Caroline seeing the video on Facebook. So,
well, listen, thanks very much for sharing your experience with us, Marion. I really appreciate it. Sounds shocking indeed. Lawrence is a homeowner in the Killigordon area. Lawrence, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Greg, and thanks for having me on.
I'm sorry to be speaking to you in this context because it started raining about 4:30 on Friday. How quickly did you realise this was going to be a problem for you?
Within about 10, 15 minutes. After that, I went out and it was heavy rain about 4:30. And the next time I went out again, the flood was ready to come in the door. I had a barrier already and sitting in the house in case of flooding. That I used before. This is this maybe second, third time. And I put the barrier across, but I couldn't do anything else with the water out on the road, which is about 5 metres out from the door. And only for the good work of my neighbours, they were there. They were finishing up work. They were there within 10 minutes. I would have been in a lot worse situation, but the water still got into the house, into the kitchen, 4 inches, and into the little dining room again. So this is the worst time ever. Now, it's an ongoing issue for the last 12 years, and I have been on to the council and writing them to them. And in fairness, the council did come out and do what the thought was necessary at different times. And regarding the flooding. At this time now, I think I had two council workers out, an overseer and another man this morning early, and nothing can be done until engineers come and assess the problem.
And Lawrence, from your own perspective, I mean, obviously the water will quickly subside, but I imagine there's an absolute mess in the house. Is this your own property? Like, are you responsible for bringing it back up to a livable standard for yourself, Lawrence?
Yeah, I'm not hearing you too well, Greg, because of
Sorry.
The signal.
No problem. I should speak a little louder. What I'm saying is this your property? Are you responsible for its repair now? Because it's going to be left in a mess even though the water is gone.
Yeah, well, I've been working to 12 o'clock on Friday night and then on Saturday again, mucking out the kitchen, throwing out mats and whatever. But I've sort of got sort of used to the idea of the flooding for the number of years. And I'll just appeal to the engineers at this stage to come and have a good look at what's happening. And when the water passed my place down the road, it went into other neighbours, ripped up concrete and destroyed another man's garden completely, just washed decorative stones away into a burn. And what the solution is, just it'll be up to the engineers. I'm not an engineer, but
can you pinpoint something that happened 12 years ago that led to this? I mean, are we seeing more rain, or was there a development?
Rain, and I think the pipework has been overwhelmed and it's not able to take the flow of water now, and with maybe something to do with climate change, there are more extreme flooding everywhere and storms and whatever. And but a lot, I mean, what way back years ago, maybe the pipework everywhere was sufficient enough to take the water flow, but not anymore. It needs to be looked at, especially here in this area anyway, where I am. And there's a lot of high land above me. And
yeah, everything, so, every bit of development contributes to it. Every new house, maybe it's new water going into the drain or taking runoff or whatever it might be. Finally, Lawrence, obviously you've been through a very difficult experience. You've got a great attitude you shouldn't have to have in that, you know, roll your sleeves up and sort of get the house clean because you're somewhat used to this happening. But we don't want this happen. We don't want this happen to gain. But what I wanted to say is you're blessed, obviously, in fair play to having brilliant people around you in terms of neighbours and those that were...
Can I mention some of the neighbours' names that helped me?
The airwaves are yours, Lawrence. You name whoever you like that helped you.
Right. Well, first of all, I have my next-door neighbour here, Sean Kelly, and his son, Stephen. And Seamus Dunahy and his son, Dara, came with a tractor and, what else, ling box. David Byrne, down the road as well, that got damage done. Martin Lynch, who was talking to this morning earlier, and Mickey Gibson, who lives further down the road, about a half a mile from here. As soon as he heard anything was going on, he knew that I'd be in danger and came to help. And without all them people, like, I'm more grateful.
All right, Lawrence. Listen, hopefully we can get to a solution here so that you don't have to live in fear of this happening again. And fair play to your great neighbours and friends that were there for you, Lawrence.
And even, you know, when the council put in some pipes here way back years ago, I was more left in charge to clean the grittings and stuff like that, keep the leaves away off them. And it's just sad to see the road all being ripped up.
All right, Lawrence, listen, thank you for your time and an awful weekend you've been through. Councillor Patrick McGowan has been waiting patiently, listening to both Lawrence and Marion there. Thank you for your time this morning, Councillor. I do appreciate it. I mean, you heard from Lawrence there. He sounds like a very pragmatic individual. He sounds like he should be more peed off than he actually is, but he's clearly an absolute gentleman. There's just no doubt about that. But what is the story? What needs to be done now to stop this happening in this Drumfergus area of Killygordon? I mean, firstly, if you want to start with what you learned about what happened on Friday evening.
Yeah, well, just I hadn't been long down from there. Yeah. As you know, we had the minister and just an order making just to come the official opening. Now, just as that was finishing out, there was quite a bit of mizzle coming on around, you know, and I went home. And a few hours later then, I just got the phone call from neighbours up there and couldn't believe it was that bad, because where I was looking out, it was just still muzzling. So I landed over there and obviously the main flash flood, if you want to call it that, had just sort of... had just gone by, and there was water running all over the fields, like just everywhere, and there was quite a bit of damage. As I say, there's probably about 50 to 100 metres of road completely washed away. It was about 4 to 6 inches of tar and such just sitting there all bubbled up, lying in lumps. There's big tracks down the side of the road, and as I say, a lot of this had washed into Lawrence's house. He was the first house in that road, and then a lot of the debris and everything else, they went down into people's gardens, just washed away all their stones and things around their nice gardens, their driveways, everything. But the place was just, it was an absolute mess.
In terms of fixing this, is this a problem in terms of drainage in front of these houses or along these houses, or are the problems much further up, which would make it a much bigger job in terms of controlling this flood water?
Yeah, in my opinion, it's much further up. I've said this before when this happened. The council has been out different times and they've repiped drains and diverted drains further up. But, and, you know, they've done some work lower down, but it's too late when it's flooded. They need to go up. There's actually two roads here. There's an upper road and a lower road, and the water's running down through one road into the fields. And I know the council have been out, and this is very important. I've been speaking to local property owners, or landowners, trying to get an agreement. And this is something you would have heard councillors talking about many years ago, 40, 50 years ago. You had land drainage committees in the council. The council wouldn't work with landowners because it seems to be there's obviously these big summer flash floods coming, and a lot of landowners and property owners and forestry and everything else do a lot of their own draining, but they just drain to the end of their property, and we seem to be getting a lot more water.
But the problem is, I know you're talking about this, and that's historic. Going back 40, 50 years ago, there's one office in Donegal Town that coordinated all of this. And we spoke to the gentleman in the past that used to work in that office, and they didn't see any of these problems. It was all joined up thinking. We're not there. We've been talking about trying to get there for a number of years, of course, and I don't think that's going to be the solution going forward with respect. So how serious are the council taking the issue of the flooding in this area? We can't have people like Lawrence and others living in fear of this floodwater. Patrick, are you getting any sense from those you're speaking to that they have a solution in mind?
No, I, to be honest with you, I'm frustrated about this as well, because it's that area, and there's two roads on either side, and they're being flooded as well. It's coming, it's halfway down a hill near Glenelly School there. And the problem is, to me, they're addressing the problem in the wrong area. They're addressing the problem down at Lawrence's house. So they need to go up and divert some of the water away. The one thing the council needs here, and this is nearly always the case, they need cooperation with landowners, saying that very clearly. If they don't, the council, now what happens in this case here now, the council will go out to an engineer investigator. They will apply to the department for a special grant now to resurface that road and to put in more drains. But if they just put the same drains in the same place, we're going to get the exact same problem.
But there is a responsibility, is there not, with landowners to make sure those drains are cleared, that the runoff from their land doesn't necessarily go out onto roads. I mean, maybe they have to get a little bit tough here, because I don't think anyone would want to feel that their inaction is causing this kind of heartache and inconvenience to someone like Lawrence, an absolute gentleman.
No, and you're 100% right. There's also the case that landowners believe that water is entering their property from an upper road or from somebody else. And it's this sort of, every year now, the council, within the HMD, the council's doing about four or five community assistance schemes where they're working with landowners' property, doing drainage, putting in pipes and re-diverting, all working together very, very successfully. Lots of people out there know these schemes and see them happening. So there is funding through the department. You have to apply and prioritise. This would certainly be a priority. And the council will have to redouble their efforts. It's up to the council. Mm. And if it is a case that landowners are not cooperating, then the council is called the local authority.
You see, I'm all for getting funding, right? Getting funding, getting works approved and all that kind of stuff. And I know what has to be done to do that. What I'm not hearing, though, is anyone telling you, and us, if they wanted to, a solution. What are they seeking funding for? What are they going to do about it? What will fix this problem? Do you know, there's no point fixing that road again, putting up a few signs, changing a pipe, when it seems quite clear, and I've never been there. And my first question was, is this a local problem or is it further up? So you know what I mean? And you've been there and you identify that. So what people like Lawrence need is solutions. What's going to fix this? And then we'll talk about getting some funding and spending it. That's what's absent in this conversation. You've got a theory. I have a theory. Lawrence has a theory. But we have very expert people, I would hope, working within the county council to say, this is what's causing it. This is how we fix it. That's what people like Lawrence want to hear, I think, Patrick.
Yeah, well, I think Lawrence and I and most of the neighbours down there will be all in one mind of what needs to be done and how it needs to be done. And the council has been doing small remedial works, which has obviously not, it's actually got worse, if truth be told, when you look at what happened, that's the worst yet. So the council knows now what to do. I would say they're very little design work. I think they could do it straight away, but they're going to have to use the authority, part of the local authority, to go in and do it. And it's no good here. They can't wait any longer. And if they're going to spend money now, which will have to open that road again, they have to start with the drainage and then do the road and save these houses, because certainly, and only for them good neighbours, like, and I did see them all out helping their large situation would be a lot worse. And it is left himself. You'll be told to go to insurance, but you're not getting insurance for that year after year. So
no, and it's no way to, because, you know, you talked about it being a mizzle. You never really know what's happening half a kilometre up the road and what's going to come washing down the hill. And he doesn't deserve to be living in those circumstances. You know, he's a taxpayer like the rest of us, and it's not his fault. And you recognise that too, by the way. I hope you don't think I'm preaching to you. I think we're on the same page on this.
300%.
Right. Okay, well, listen, keep us in the loop on it, Patrick, and hopefully a resolution is found. Thank you very much for your time this morning. It's greatly appreciated. 086 60 25000, WhatsApps and texts to that number. Now, they are forecasting some wet weather over Tuesday night into Wednesday, but beyond that, for the next couple of weeks, their long-range forecasts are telling us that things might be quite dry. Right, OK, we are joined in studio now by John Joe McGowan, who's Chief Ambulance Officer with HSE West. Thank you so much for joining us, John Joe. Good to have you on the programme.
Good morning, Greg.
We're talking about the Pathfinder Alternative Care Pathway. It's one of a number of measures being introduced at Letterkenny University Hospital to address overcrowding at the ED. So can you talk us through it, John Joe? This is a trial, is it?
Yeah, no, not so much a trial. It was trialled in Dublin, Greg. So Pathfinder's a new service being introduced in Donegal. It's an initiative between the National Ambulance Service and the Letterkenny University Hospital, and it includes a team which respond to or low-priority 999 calls for older adults. So this team basically goes out to the scene of the low-priority calls and assesses the medical, functional and mobility assessment of the patient, and that's all with a view to keeping the patient at home as opposed to transporting them to the busy ED department. So the team is made up of, it's a multidisciplinary team, it's made up of advanced paramedics from our side, and then from the hospital side it's made up, and the community side also, it's made up of two physiotherapists and two occupational therapists. And as I say, their view is to go to this call set or group of calls in our low acuity or our low priority calls and assess the patients with a view to keeping them at home.
Have you any concerns that this might take a while to bed in that you might have patients or their families that want to err on the side of caution, and they might feel the hospital setting is the right place for that, even though all the gear, all the expertise might be at the house? But you know what I mean? They probably got to the point where they've made a decision that the loved one needs the care that a hospital can give.
Yeah, exactly, Greg. So when somebody dials 999, they're nearly always in that position that they've done all they can at home. They've predominantly gone to the pharmacist and got the medications over the counter and so on and so forth. But yeah, that's definitely, and that's what one of the team's trained to do, is speak with the family members, speak with the patient first of all, and then also speak with the family members to reassure them. But the team also has two sets. So the first part of the team is to go out, assess the patient with this view, and then there's a follow-up part to the team where within 24 hours they make contact with the patient again and then further assessment. As opposed to also just leaving the patient at home, I suppose it does what it says on the tin. It's a Pathfinder project, so it finds alternative pathways for the patient.
Because there are another group out there, John Joe, who might be reluctant to call 999 because they don't want to end up in hospital. And you know, there could be poor outcomes as a result of that. So there might be a counterbalance there. In other words, we might catch people that ordinarily might delay to the last minute to call an ambulance.
Yeah, exactly. So you do have that the two ends of the spectrum, one of them being the patients that don't want to call an ambulance because ultimately don't end up in the hospital. And that's one of the groups of patients that this team is geared to help with that view to keeping them out of the hospital, send them on an alternative pathway, and hopefully avoiding that experience of long hospital delays, etc.
Now, of course, you know, you're using medical language in terms of low level and that type of stuff, and you know, what might be deemed as low level and not requiring acute hospital might be quite serious to someone else, and you know, that's very understandable, the language that you use, because that's how you prioritise patients and what have you. Yeah. So what kind of calls do you think might be able to be dealt with at home? It's going to be on a case-by-case basis with a full assessment, don't get me wrong. But can you give us sort of some examples of cases that might end up in ED waiting to be assessed on site that might be able to be sorted by this this other system?
Yeah. So this Pathfinder predominantly looks at the over 65s, and the call sets that we were going for that would be things like non-traumatic back pain, falls, sick persons, that's prioritised through our triage system as a lower priority sick person, and traumatic injuries that's not life-threatening. So when you dial 999, Greg, you're put through a triage system, and that categorises the calls into six categories. On one end of the spectrum, you have your echoes and deltas, which is very serious, life-threatening calls, your cardiac arrest, your respiratory arrest, your chest pains. And then on the other side of the spectrum is your alpha and omega calls. So that's what this group is aimed at, is these alpha and omega call groups.
A lot of people attend Letterkenny University Hospital with respiratory complaints.
Yeah.
Would they be classed as sort of alpha and delta?
The respiratory complaints, depending on the severity, and the triage system sort of determines that. Some, most predominantly, would be classed as delta. Your shortnesses of breath are predominantly all delta calls. But then on the other side, there is small one, say the likes of the colds and flus, or the flus with the high temperatures and all that there. And they can be very serious for the elderly.
Yeah, and that's why you have the experts that call out. I get that. But
exactly.
Like dehydration, things like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, all them things. And the clinical assessment will come into play with the advanced paramedic. Mm. And then the other assessments will come in with the occupational therapists and the functionality assessments and the mobility assessments. And this team also carries with it equipment, the likes of walking frames or commodes and different things like that will be able to help the elderly in their day-to-day living.
I mean, in your heart of hearts, do you see this as... I mean, we know the necessity of this, okay? And we'll talk a little bit more about the impact it might have. But in your heart of hearts, do you see this as an advancement in terms of the care of the elderly, who are already feeling like they're the root of all problems, you know, the way things are presented in the media? Me and you don't believe that, but I've talked about that on this program before. So do you see this an advancement and an improvement of healthcare for them? Is it maybe a step back to keep them out of the acute hospital, or is it a sideways step whereby they're going to get the same level of care, but just maybe in a different environment?
No, it's most definitely an advancement, Greg. Everything now is moving towards care of the patient closer to the home.
Most want that, don't they?
Yes, exactly. So it's most definitely advancement. This is a highly skilled team of a multidisciplinary scale that will be able to bring basically the hospital services that they would get in hospital to the home. Yeah. And again, that follow-up gives the reassurance to the patient that they're not being left alone. We're not just going out and seeing them and they're being left there. But it's that follow-up piece that gives the reassurance and helps them.
And I hope you know, I'm sure you do, the motivation for my questions is to help in that reassurance, not to in any way question the service. So presumably then, this means that a person who qualifies for this, and that's all done through the triage, by the way, no risks are going to be taken, absolutely sure of that, that they will get treatment or retention much quicker. I mean, rather than maybe being in an ambulance for a couple of hours outside the hospital or being in the ED on uncomfortable chairs waiting to be triaged and maybe eventually seen, they might have that in the comfort of their armchair in the front room or in their bed in the house. I mean, and also then, of course, it can be difficult when people have been checked over and, you know, things aren't as bad as things might seem. Yeah. There still can be delays in discharge. So they're in there when they don't really even need to be in there and they want to go home as well. It's impossible to put a figure on this, I'd imagine. Or is it? Like, how many cases do you think this might take from the acute hospital? Or how do you feel it might impact the services there? Because this is part of a raft of things, isn't it? It's not one thing. It's no silver bullet. This is one of many initiatives. So can you give a sense of what kind of impact you think this will have on the hospital?
Yeah, so in terms of figures, off our call volume, 20% fall into that low acuity bracket. So if you take, for instance, in the Northwest, on average, we do about between 60 and 60 being a good day, 75 being a very busy day. We do about 60 to 75 calls a day. So we're hopefully having 20% of that volume seen by this team. Then in addition to that, this team that it was previously set up in Dublin, on average, it's keeping about 60 to 70% of their patients at home. So it's quite a high percentage of being kept at home. Which
I hope
is
this works. I think this could be really, really significant, especially with through no fault of the hospital necessarily, hospital acquired illness as well. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Where someone goes into hospital for something and ends up catching something else. It happens all the time, and we've talked to the hospital manager about it. It's no slight on them. Here's a text. Had this service for our elderly father at the end of last year for dehydration. After a couple of hours, he was comfortable in our own home, a great service. That's the kind of thing we're talking about then, yeah?
So, yeah, that caller's probably talking about, as this service is not live yet, it goes live this week. That caller's probably talking about another service that we have, which is the community paramedic service. And that is, again, like the Pathfinder service. Its view is to keep people at home and treated at home. So that's a paramedic or an advanced paramedic on their own, going to lower acuity calls with a different... They look at things like the dehydration, they look at the catheterization and stuff like that there, and the generally unwell people, again, with a view to keeping them at home as well.
What impact might this have on ambulance availability and response times?
Yeah, so we've well broadcasted, Greg, that we have a demand versus capacity issue. Our demand is growing day on day and our capacity isn't growing as fast. So we hope it's one of the strings in the bows to help alleviate this pressures that we're seeing on the ambulance service in the county. As I say, we have other initiatives ongoing, the likes of the community paramedic. We have a clinical hub, so when you dial 999 now, it goes through a further assessment by a doctor and a nurse and an advanced paramedic for, again, these low priority calls. So again, as you said earlier, it's no silver bullet, but hopefully with all these things coming together, we hope to keep on top of that demand with this additional capacity. We've also made it well known that we're in a massive recruitment buzz at the minute. So we're recruiting. We hope to double our workforce in the next 5 to 7 years.
This is in Donegal?
All over nationally. Over the last year, we've increased our staff count by 12. And we hope to, in August this year again, increase it by another 7. They're small numbers.
This is kind of a random one, but you know what? It might fall on one or two sets of ears. Yeah. If someone has an interest in this and they're 16 or 17, you know what I mean? And they're listening or whatever, and they might have an interest in this area of health. What do you study? Like, what is the pathway to qualification in this area?
Yeah, so your science subjects in your Leaving Cert would be one of the big ones. And then maybe get involved in some of the voluntary organisations throughout the country, the likes of the Order of Malta, the Red Cross, St John's Ambulance and that there to view. And that gives a sort of an inkling into what's to come in this service.
Well, that's it. And this is your long-term plan. Because I remember the time of the crash, 2008, 2009. Yeah. There was no one went to study architecture.
Yeah.
And then three or four years later, when things turned around, there was no one coming out, because we think in the moment, you know, rather than what might be coming down the line in 3 or 4 years. So Corliss says, does this mean, for example, that antibiotics via IV and O2 needed will be put on at the spot, if appropriate, of course, instead of taking the elderly person from the warm bed in the district hospitals and nursing homes to LUHED? So we've been talking about residential responses. So does this apply to...
Yeah.
Go ahead, yep.
No, not so much residential responses. This is more in the home. The residential responses, this team is set up for more mobility and functionality assessment. So it's moving away slightly from that medical. Now, it's very much in its infancy, and the team will expand throughout the years. But
presumably there's an element of professional triaging done in a nursing home, is there,
yes,
or a district
exactly.
hospital? That, in other words, they're far more at an advanced stage to make a call on whether acute hospital admission is required.
Exactly,
I'd imagine we don't have that skills base in the home.
Yeah, exactly. And most residential. Nursing homes and that have the likes of GPs attached to them. They have a nursing cohort of staff, and they have a more advanced assessment technique, and they have more access to assessments that you wouldn't have in your home. So thus ruling that group of calls out.
For the time being.
For the time being, yeah, most
and
definitely.
When does the Pathfinder alternative care pathway then begin to be rolled out, or are we speaking as it is?
So the team started this morning. Now they have a number, they have a training element to go through for about a week and a half. And that's different things, like they have to do their manual handling training. They're coming from the hospital setting. It's a slightly different techniques and that in the community. They have a MAPA training course, and that's to deal with violence and aggression that may come across in the on scenes. And then they have a number of the occupational therapists and the physiotherapists have to do their advanced life support training, etc. So that takes about, and they're going for a ride along with the Dublin team. Also for a number of days. So we hope, not that we hope, but we aim to go live on next Wednesday the 12th.
Okay.
To tender first calls. That is.
And presumably no risks will be taken.
No, definitely not.
If this team determine that the best care for the individual is in hospital, they will still be transported to the hospital.
Exactly, Greg. Yeah, following the assessments, and they are detailed medical assessments. If it's deemed that the patient is best suited to go into the hospital, that's where they'll be going.
Right, okay. As I say, the listeners will decide what they think. It's just I know, and we get contacted by a lot of people that I think would far prefer to get the peace of mind or attention in their home rather than be... That's exactly. Very stressful to be transported to the hospital, despite the best efforts. Then the delays, either in the ambulance or on chairs, you know what I mean? And then even getting discharged, it can be. So hopefully if this helps the people, we hope it will, that's all good. All right, okay. So this will be just rolled out. It'll become clear. Have you any message to people when these teams arrive? In other words, in terms of trust, or this is something new, or listen, we want her to go to the hospital.
Yeah, although it's a new service, the people on this team are highly experienced OTs, physios and advanced paramedics. They've been, I know from the paramedic side alone, like you could have up to 40, 50 years experience in that team. They're highly skilled professionals. They will not take any risk. The ambulance service and the hospitals and all medical services are completely a risk-averse organisation. So they will always err on the side of caution. So just for your listeners not to be worried about that side of things. Again, the follow-up will also help in relation to giving that reassurance and assessment and looping back in within the 24 hours. And again, if the patient's condition does ever deteriorate after that call, we would advise them to call 999 straight away again, and we'll have an ambulance with them.
Yeah, and their previous visit will be on file and a further decision be able to make.
Exactly, and that's one of the good things about this team too, Greg, is they can tie in with the hospital file systems, and they'll be able to get the past medical history and all that off the patients.
Right. Know your air code, put it on the fridge as well, if you're listening.
Exactly, yeah.
John Joe McGowan, Chief Ambulance Officer with the HSC West, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Greg.